I'm going to start at lightning speed with some thank yous. I'll be very brief because I want to get on with the lecture proper. I want to thank, I've been at Sussex for 20 years, as Michael indicated. My greatest debt is to my wife, who's wonderful, who has put up with me for 20 years and who I met here. Colleagues in so many different schools. And by colleagues, I don't just mean academic colleagues, I also mean the administrators who've prevented me from committing heinous administrative crimes for so long. In the School of Social Sciences, in the School of English and American Studies, in the School of Humanities, and most recently in the School of History, Art, History and Philosophy. Colleagues in the History Department, old and new, and the students that it's been a privilege to teach for so long in history and intellectual history and all the joint majors who are associated with history. And then the intellectual historians, I've been privileged to be part of a very small unit that, as Michael said, has the highest reputation. I remember talking about Jean-Baptiste Say, which I'm not going to do, thank goodness, tonight. But I remember producing a manuscript. It was about 500 A4 pages on Jean-Baptiste Say, the basis of a monograph, handing it to my two colleagues, Donald Winch and Brian Young, on the Friday afternoon, and I received it back on the Monday morning with every single page annotated. I wouldn't do that for anybody, I don't think. But the fact that they did and helped so much, I've just been blessed by the most wonderful colleagues, Knud Hawkinson, the late John Burrow. So this university for me has been fantastic. I've been supported so much, and I wanted to say thank you. I just want to say another special thanks, in addition to the one to my wife, to Donald Winch, because his support has been so constant. He wouldn't like me to put it in these terms, but it's been like having Dad on the faculty. So that's the end of the thank yous. Now, I'm going to talk about democracy and empire, and I'm going to make an argument, and I'm going to make an argument as an intellectual historian. Now, intellectual history, it can be defined in lots and lots of different ways. The late John Burrow defined it as eavesdropping on the conversations of the past. Now, if you eavesdrop on the conversations of the past, then you have to be attuned to the voices, to the historic voices, and you have to reconstruct the context in which the voices are making arguments, are making claims, are being involved in controversy. Now, many intellectual historians, and certainly Sussex intellectual history, is obsessed with a very precise and particular development of context. Now, I'm not going to give you that tonight. I'm going to give you a very broad brush context. But it's really listening to the voices of the past, reconstructing the conversations, putting them in context, searching for the change in ideas. You're always delighted as an intellectual historian if you can identify a transformation of ideas. Also, you're looking to recapture lost voices. And what I want to do tonight is give you an example of an argument that's really been forgotten, and I'll try and explain why, and I'm going to recover it in part. Again, it'll be in very general terms, because I don't want to bore you, but I'll try and recover it. Now, it's to do with democracy and empire, and it's to do with the claim that was really obvious to 18th century minds, which was that democracy was incompatible with empire entirely. If you wanted a democracy, you had to have a small state. And in any case, democracies, if they could be found anywhere, were everywhere in decline. Where you could find them, they were collapsing. They were really something to be looked back to in ancient times or during the Renaissance or in the small states that might exist across Europe. I'm going to come back to them a lot. But the argument was made that if you wanted a democracy, it had to be a small state, and it had to be, and it was impossible to imagine the kind of transformation that's sometimes associated with the history of Rome, which was that you would transform a democracy from a tiny state, Rome, into a large empire. The argument was made, well, it was simply inconceivable. You wouldn't associate democracy with empire at all. After the French Revolution, things change. In the 1790s, we have the French creating their republic and the British seeing that republic as a democracy and attacking it as a democracy for that reason. Now, you can see this is a print by Rowlandson. I'm going to give you quite a few Rowlandsons. From 1792, you can see that Rowlandson is responding to the French Revolution. He's responding, he calls it philosophy run mad, a stupendous monument of human wisdom, and he's making the claim that the French are hypocrites and that what the French are doing is claiming, for example, to have abolished offensive war. You can see the cannon, firing out the cannonballs. They claim to be abolishing war. In fact, they're conducting war across the globe. The lovely little Republic of Geneva, you can just see in the right-hand corner, has fallen before French arms. They're at the gates of Geneva when Rowlandson was doing this print. And you can see humanity, social happiness, security, all of the parts of the pillar of civilized society have collapsed. There's the harridan Marianne standing on top of them. And we see the assignat coming out of the conch. The assignat was the paper money that the British writers claimed was substanceless and fake and a symbol of the dreadful nature of French so-called civilization. The argument was made that the French were pretending to create civilization, whereas in fact they were destroying it. Again, the symbols of humanity, the heart being pulled out and the guillotined head with the public clapping, with the sans-culotte displaying the head for the public, standing and claiming to stand for law and liberty. So that's what you get, Rowlandson made the claim, when you have a democracy. And I'll be looking at some of the consequences in the lecture. But I want to pose a question. It's something really for you to think about while I'm talking, and it comes back to Scotland. Now this, it's not a particularly good image. I don't think you'll be able to read much of the poem underneath the print. This is from 1782. It's anonymous. We think it's by Bartolozzi. But it describes the character Sawney. Sawney, as those of you who've studied English abuse of Scots, we'll know that Sawney was a cannibal from East Lothian, reputed to have lived in the 14th century. And when English writers wanted to attack the Scots, they would use the image of Sawney. And here he is. He's been invited down from Scotland by Peg. Peg, in the poem underneath, is John Bull's sister. John Bull invited her down because she was so poor. She comes down from north of the Tweed, and she brings with her, of course, her boyfriend, Sawney, and very, very quickly, they begin to destroy John Bull's good English house. And the poem underneath goes, "She perverted John's wife, as I have been told, who from a good housewife was grown a great scold. And by drinking strong liquor, in Scotland called whiskey, was grown beyond measure, wrong-headed and frisky." Now, the poem goes on to describe in a lot of detail. It can be sung, actually, but I'm obviously not going to do that. It describes how dreadful the Scots are. They are barbaric, they're cruel, they are rough, they're wastrel libertines, and they spread their poverty. That's the claim. Now, of course, there's equal evidence of the alternative point of view. From a Scottish perspective, the English are selfish, they're superior, they are perfidious, they're obsessed with money, they are tyrannical masters. There's lots and lots of examples of this kind of abuse at the end of the 18th century. My favourite example, actually, is a letter from the Irish Lord Shelburne, written in 1786 to the Welsh dissenting minister Richard Price. And Shelburne, he was very close to Price, and he would sometimes write things to him that he wouldn't say publicly. And he wrote that he was looking forward to death because he was sure that in heaven there would be no Scots to ask him for money or a job. Now, again, I've given you one side. There's plenty of abuse the other way. And you can see that it's not a particularly good state of the union, you would say, given this kind of evidence. And yet, at the same time as this abusive literature, English to the Scots, Irish and Welsh to the Scots as well, and back from the Scots to the English and to all parties, at the same time, European readers, European writers are becoming more and more fascinated by Scotland. They're fascinated by Scottish history, by Scottish manners, by religion, by law. And the question is why? Now, if I asked my students, I'm sure, would say, well, it's because of the Scottish Enlightenment. People were interested in the great authors, Adam Smith, David Hume, Adam Ferguson, Hugh Blair, the long, long list of great writers associated with the Scottish Enlightenment. Actually, in this case, it's a genuine interest across Europe in Scottish history. The work that people are very interested in is William Robertson's History of Scotland. And the question is why? Why are the Europeans, despite the evidence of antagonism within the polity, why across Europe is there a fascination with Scotland? And I want you to think about that. And unless I run way over time, I'll tell you why at the end, towards the end of the lecture. Now, really explaining why the 18th century, why ideas change across the 18th century, why the 18th century and into the 19th century is fascinating. I've got to go the other way. In fact, I'm not going to do that one yet. It's fascinating. Comes down to what I call alternative futures and transition mechanisms. I've said those words so often to my students that some of them will fall asleep now. But I'll explain it to those of you who haven't heard me talk about alternative futures and transition mechanisms before. Alternative futures is really the distinctiveness, captures for me the distinctiveness of 18th century thought. The 18th century shouldn't have turned out the way that it did. From a 17th century perspective, the 18th century should have seen the rise of France to hegemonic position across Europe. France, especially under Louis XIV, should have become a global power, and yet that didn't happen. The main reason why France did not rise to dominion was because of Britain. Obviously, Britain after the union with Scotland in 1707. Britain challenges France, and the rise of Britain perplexes contemporaries, because Britain is so inferior. It's inferior in population, that's the perspective anyway, in terms of civilization, in terms of natural resources. France ought to be the greater state. And yet the British are superior at war. Now, trying to explain why the British are superior at war perplexes or fascinates lots and lots of writers. Some argue that it's the composite nature of the British polity. It's the fact that you have, again, back to this civilized English part, and you have a barbaric Celtic fringe that you can draw on when you need to fight wars. Another argument is that why do the British win the wars in the 18th century? They win the wars in the 18th century because their army is German, because of the link with the House of Hanover and the fact that they can draw on German mercenaries whenever they need them. But those are superficial responses. The fact is that most contemporaries think that Britain has risen. Britain is remarkable in war. Historically mixed states like Britain, composite monarchies, have not been able to stand against absolute monarchies in terms of war. And many argue that Britain simply cannot last as a great state. Its rise has to do with commerce. It has to do with the fact that it can draw on public credit, the foundation of the Bank of England, 1694, following the Dutch model, has allowed the British state to draw revenues and pay interest on a debt into the future that supports vast armies, that changes the nature of warfare. But few think the British can remain superior to the French in war. And many argue that the future cannot be predicted. Some think that France, the glory of France, will be restored, that the natural order of things in Europe, you might call it, will be restored. For others, Britain must collapse. It simply makes no sense that Britain is as powerful as it is. Others, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, for example, the Genevan writer and philosopher, in the fifth book of his famous novel, Emile, published in 1762, Rousseau argued that you could expect a new dark age, that what's happening in the 18th century is that you're reliving the history of Rome, and what is going to happen is there's going to be bankruptcy when the commercial monarchies of Britain and France collapse through bankruptcy or civil war. And then the barbarians from the east will come again. Rousseau expects the Russians. He expects the Tsar to send an army into Europe to defeat the commercial monarchies. And then he expects the Russian army to break up into tribes, inaugurating a new dark age. So you can see that there are lots of alternative futures being speculated about. What I like a lot about 18th century authors into the 19th century is that when they are speculating about alternative futures, they are not just obsessed with the alternative future, they're also obsessed with describing the precise transition mechanism by which you move from a state of corruption, from the problematic present, to the alternative future. They don't just say, wouldn't it be great if things were different? They precisely delineate and articulate how you get from where you are to the alternative. Now, if there was an alternative future that nobody would have anticipated in the 18th century, it was the rise of democracy, what we would call democracy. What would we call democracy? There is a question. Again, I've asked students for so many years, and the answers that you get back, very good ones, that democracy is associated with the rights of man, that democracy is, so human rights, as we would call it today, democracy is associated with representative government, democracy is associated with popular sovereignty, with the rule of the people. Now, in the 18th century, most authors who think about democracy attack it. They attack democracy for lots of reasons. But they think of democracy as the people making the law themselves. They think that it really is, you have a democracy where the people are political agents themselves. And that's why the British, even though in the French Revolution there aren't that many Frenchmen or French women who call themselves Democrats, the French didn't define the French Revolution as a democratic revolution, but looking at it from the outside, from the British perspective, that's exactly what it was. It might have been government by representation, but actually it was the people, either the mobs, the Paris mobs, standing in the galleries of the National Assembly or of the Convention, influencing the making of law, or directly coercing and pushing and pressing the politicians to pass particular laws. The people, it was argued, were making the law themselves. And from a British perspective, that's what was so terrible about it. Democracy in the 18th century, for the most part, is a term of abuse. That's what Rowlandson was attacking, as I'll show you in a minute. Democracy was associated with war, partly because of the history of democracy with the ancient, with the classical world, or the Renaissance republics. They're always warlike states. Democracy is associated with civil war, with people supporting demagogues, false orators who lead the people to follow the demagogue's interest rather than the good of everybody. Democracy is the rule of the ignorant, it was claimed. You remember, and again, I don't have to say this to students I've taught because I've used this example so many times, but Plato's example of the ship. The ship must be run by a rational, wise captain. And when you have democracy, it's as if you ask a member of the crew to take control, to become captain of the ship. What is the result going to be? It's going to be anarchy. It's going to be the rule of the ignorant. It's going to be a mess. So democracy gets a bad press. The remarkable thing about Europe in the 18th century is that democracies do exist. They're not associated with the large states. One thing that was so shocking about the French Revolution, that it was seen to be an attempt to create a democracy where you could never logically have had a democracy before in a large state. Rather, the places that called themselves democracies were the tiny communities, the small states. And you have to think of Europe as a multitude, a patchwork. It's like a quilt with so many different kinds of state, theocracies, principalities, and many of them call themselves democracies and were proud to do so and rejected the historic criticisms. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. This isn't the Vice Chancellor's plan for New Haven Fort. It's actually a place called Hesdin, which has actually been destroyed by war. But you can see that it's a community surrounded by walls. This image comes from the Civitas Orbis Terrarum, which is the Cities of the World, published by Brown and Hogenberg between 1582-1617. It's a wonderful book. It's of lots and lots and lots of cities. And what characterizes almost all of them, unless there's lots of water around them, are walls. And Europe is a continent of walled cities. There's another one. This is Aachen or Aix-la-Chapelle. Again, later on, they become star-shaped. What communities do, they spend a vast proportion of the resources of the state on building walls. You might live in the hinterland, but if there was ever a problem, if anybody invaded your state, you'd run inside those walls. You'd be protected. You would live your life potentially within them, if you lived it within the city. Again, you can see the mass of the streets. Again, these days we associate them with medieval quarters, we call them, but actually this kind of city characterizes the whole of Europe. And many of these city-states call themselves democracies. That's the point that I want to make. Now, the problem for these small states with the walls was that large states had become dominant. The traditional survival strategies employed by the small states, by the little communities, to maintain themselves no longer worked. Historically, maintaining a small state, you would rely on alliances. You might be part of a federal republic, as in the case of the Dutch or the Swiss cantons. You might rely on a balance of power, the large states competing with one another. You might rely on economic specialization, the republics like Venice, Genoa, and such like, you might rely on the fact that you're tiny and that large states are not interested in you. By the 18th century, it was clear, well, you'd also rely on your walls, of course, and you might rely on the patriotism, the love of your people who lived within the walls for the city-state, for the state that they were part of. You rely on their virtue, their manliness, often associated with life in republics. But none of those strategies by the 18th century, certainly by the middle decades, work. They don't work because large states rule. And large states want to develop themselves commercially. One of the ways they can develop themselves commercially is by establishing large markets, and therefore there is an incentive to eat up the small states and make them part of a greater commercial empire. And this happens across the continent. There's lots and lots of prints about Poland. Again, you might have heard of the partition of Poland. But this print, which is a Gilray from 1787, describes the Dutch, the cutting, the potential destruction of the Dutch Republic. It's being divided. We have the foppish with the shears, Louis XVI. We have George III pulling on the Cape of Good Hope. And we have the Prussian Frederick William using his knife to cut at Ceylon. And then we have the Holy Roman Emperor Joseph cutting with his saber right through the middle. Now, this print really describes what's going on. The walls are coming down. They can no longer maintain themselves. And this is the Dutch Republic. This is the great commercial miracle of the 17th century. In the 18th century, by the 1780s, it's really in decline. It cannot stand against these large monarchies. That is the fact. But then we have the French Revolution. The French Revolution, which I'm not going to talk much about in terms of what happens during the French Revolution. But the French Revolution is a shock, but it was an attempt by the French to restore their glory. They couldn't believe, so many French writers couldn't believe, the extent of French decline. They couldn't understand why the British defeated them in war. And then, finally, in the late 1770s into the 1780s, they are successful because they defeat the British in North America. And finally, they have a victory, but through their victory, they almost go bankrupt and they begin to innovate politically in order to broaden the tax base. That's obviously in the 1780s. And then you have the revolution, which proclaims the sovereignty of the nation and which transforms the state, which then becomes a republic. Now, the British perspective on revolutionary France really follows the criticisms of democracy that have been made historically. And the perspective, this is a Cruikshank print from 1792. You can see wonderfully how the revolution is portrayed. I won't translate a couple of the words because they're too vulgar. But you can see that the revolution is associated with oppression, the oppression of the people. They're being drawn into the revolutionary army. They should be willing to go and fight for the revolutionary state, but they don't want to. One of them says, I don't want to go to glory so soon. I don't want glory. I'm being coerced by the sans-culotte. What will you get? The man leading the horse says, you will get 1 sou per day in assignat, in other words, in the paper money that is worthless, and you'll get plenty of water. That's what the revolution offers. In other words, it's associated with poverty, it's associated with oppression, it's associated with coercing the people, it's associated with a cabal of corrupt individuals taking control of the state in the name of liberty, in the name of democracy, and the consequence is horrendous. We can see, this is a Rowlandson print, we can see the fears of the British if British individuals become French and embrace French ideas. This is reform advised, reform begun, reform complete. John Bull is at his table. The blessed effects of a good constitution are manifest in front of him. Here come the French. They're all thin. They're always portrayed as thin. They never have enough to eat. In other words, famine is on the horizon. That was the prediction. The British prediction was that the French Revolution would not stand because they couldn't generate enough wealth commercially to feed the people. That's what happens in the case of John Bull. They hack off his leg, they give him a frog to eat, and then they say, now he is quite happy at the bottom when reform is complete. Now he is quite happy, I will have a jump. And they start jumping on his body. And he's supposed to be happy. That's what would happen, the claim went, if the British reformed their constitution, if they followed French ways. And again, this is another Rowlandson, 1793. It was the cover for the Anti-Gallican Songster, which was a book of songs you were supposed to sing to immunize yourself against the effects of the revolution. And again, you have the contrast, British liberty and French liberty. Obviously, the Gorgon with the head of the guillotined looking over at the Magna Carta and the Lion and the Navy and the bountiful British state, the well-fed and well-dressed figure, Britannia, defending religion, morality, loyalty, again, property, industry, national prosperity and happiness. That is what you get if you live in Britain. If you embrace French liberty, it's atheism, it's anarchy, it is murder, it is famine, it is private ruin, it is misery. That was the prediction. Now, Edmund Burke, in his famous Reflections on the Revolution in France, published in 1790, made lots of predictions. He called France, revolutionary France, a democratic state, and he attacked the democratic tyranny that he found in French politics. And he made a series of predictions about the future, and he said that the French state is corrupt. It's ruled by a mob that is corrupt. It's ruled by demagogues. They're anarchical, they're disordered, they're murderers. He predicted the terror. And Edmund Burke, for many, was seen as the greatest political genius of his age because he predicted exactly what did happen in the early years of the French Revolution. And Burke, probably initially, was pleased with himself, but something went wrong. And what went wrong was that the French state ought to have collapsed. If you've got a state that's as bad as the state that you've seen in the Rowlandson or the Cruikshank or the Gilray, it's a state that's in trouble. It's a state that's impoverished. It's a state which ought not to last. And Burke didn't expect the revolution to be successful. But it was successful in the sense that France did not collapse. The revolution was successful in war. And here we have another Cruikshank. It's as early as 1792. The lady in the foreground isn't Marie Antoinette. Some people think it's Marie Antoinette. It's actually Mad Maria I of Portugal, who I'm not going to talk about. But the point is that we have the revolutionary Marianne, the genius of France, extirpating despotism, tyranny, and oppression from the face of the earth, or the royal warriors defeated. And we have the major monarchs of Europe, the Tsarina, Catherine included, on the ass being defeated because French arms were successful. That was the point about the revolution. It was remarkably successful in terms of arms. And that was a problem for Edmund Burke. It was a problem for those who condemned the revolutionary state because it wasn't simply, it was unstable domestically, but it was seen to be capable of creating an empire. And it was the democratic nature of the empire that people were so afraid of, especially in Britain. Again, at the time that Cruikshank makes this print, the revolutionary armies have been successful in the Low Countries. They have been, the revolutionary state has claimed that it's abolished offensive war, as I said right at the start of the lecture. But Jacques-Pierre Brissot in the convention has proclaimed that the French will support any people that proclaims their own liberty and independence. They will send troops to help them. In other words, it was said about Brissot's, the law that was passed, that they would help any rebels. It will set fire across the globe. So the French are creating an empire in the name of liberty, in the name of democracy, and it means that Europe is in turmoil. Now, what happens is that in lots of the little states embrace the revolution. In 1795, the Dutch do exactly that. This is another Cruikshank, and portraying what happens to the Dutch when they embrace the revolution. What happens is the sans-culottes, again, look how thin they are, look how ragged, they're licentious, they're drinking gin, they're picking the pocket of the Dutchman as they embrace him, and they're ready to stab him in the back. So that is what you get when you embrace the revolution, when you embrace the revolutionary empire. The British message was that the small states might think that they're acquiring some kind of liberty, being part of a greater democratic empire, but the reality is the opposite. They're losing their liberty, they will lose their wealth, they will become as impoverished and as thin as the French are. It's dreadful. I will come to this one. I've got to speed up a bit. Now, if you were a member of the small states, and what I've said to you, I suppose, is that, in a nutshell, is that ideas about democracy did exist in Europe, despite the antagonism to democracy, and they're associated with the small states. They're associated with Swiss cantons, some German cities, some cities within the Holy Roman Empire, with the Dutch Republic. There are people who called themselves Democrats, but they faced a crisis because the world was increasingly characterized by states seeking large markets. And there seemed to be a choice for all small state Democrats, small state Republicans. The choice in the 1790s was either to become part of a democratic empire associated with France, or it was to embrace Britain, to follow the British model. And the question is, why were so many sceptical? Why were so many across Europe antagonistic to Britain? And the reason was that so few people, as I said earlier, had any faith in the capacity of the British to maintain their state, partly because it was almost perpetually bankrupt. The debt was rising and rising throughout the century. Partly it was the fact that France seemed to be a greater state, but it was also because of the analysis undertaken by British writers, especially by Adam Smith in his Wealth of Nations of 1776, where he identified the mercantile system, the corrupt form of commerce characterized by monopoly, the monopoly especially that carried out by the rich, the way they manipulate trade, which created what Adam Smith called an unnatural and retrograde order in modern Europe. So in other words, what Britain, because of the corrupt nature of British commerce, what the British Empire offers is commercial domination. If you allow the British, if you are allied with the British, if you allow the British to embrace you and protect you politically, what you get is dominion. You lose your independence, but you're going to be crushed commercially. So it seems that the small states, if they had a choice between commercially corrupt Britain and perfidious France, revolutionary France, it's not much of a choice. And the question really towards the end of the century was whether there was a third way. And one of the third ways that's associated with democracy that I can only refer to in passing really today is associated with Napoleon Bonaparte. Bonaparte, especially in British literature, is often called a democrat. Bonaparte was very happy with that, often encouraged his own depiction as a democratic figure, as the product of a democratic republic, obviously organized plebiscites to justify his position as emperor. And here we're back to Rowlandson, and we have the life of Bonaparte. And the argument was it was a democratic life. This is before Bonaparte becomes emperor. It's from 1800. We see him in Corsica, impoverished family, democratic innocence, they call it. Again, the association of democracy with famine. It's, you can see through the prints, it's one of the themes you find everywhere. Again, Bonaparte was from Corsica. Corsica becomes part of France in 1767. So Bonaparte, it's only because the French were eating up the small states. Corsica was part of Genoa, of the Republic. It was only because Bonaparte only became French because France was becoming a larger and larger empire. What happens to him? He's given an education by the French crown. He receives the king's bounty. What does he do? In the revolution, he turns against the crown that has supported him and he embraces the revolution. He's a hypocrite and he's corrupt, was the claim that was made. He was accused of always associating himself with the Catholic Church, but when he was invading Egypt, of becoming a Turk, as it says here, of embracing Islam. That was the claim that was made about Bonaparte. What does he then do? He abandons his own soldiers. That is democratic courage at the bottom left-hand side. He abandons his own soldiers in Egypt, and he returns to Paris a hero, whereas in fact he knows he's been defeated. Democratic honor, he turns against the Republic. The Republic, the monarchy made him, he turns against it. The Republic made him, he turns against it. He turns himself into first consul. That's him on the throne, democratic glory. And of course, the claim that Rowlandson makes is at night, all of the murders that he's committed, all of his dreadful crimes come to haunt him, and ultimately he will suffer. Obviously, at the time, Rowlandson doesn't know what's going to become of Bonaparte. One of the reasons why people like Rowlandson were so bothered about Bonaparte is obviously because he's so successful in war, but also because he presented himself as Charlemagne, as Charlemagne, as a new emperor. And Charlemagne, historically, as Holy Roman Emperor, had protected the small states of Europe. He protected the small communities, and Bonaparte explicitly did that. So Bonaparte actually represents a third way for the small state republicans. Many and Democrats, a lot of them had faith in Bonaparte. The end result, though, is war and the defeat of Napoleon. This is another Rowlandson from 1813, funking the Corsican. And all of the monarchs of Europe, including and the Dutch stadtholder, now united against Napoleon, come together, the Bavarians, the Saxons, the King of Württemberg, who was notoriously overweight, from Sweden, from Russia across the continent. Everybody is attacking him. And he says, Bonaparte's response before he falls into the barrel of gin is, "Oh, you base traitors and deserters, 1,100,000 lads of Paris shall roast every one of you alive as soon as they shall catch you." And obviously this is as he's disappearing. So ultimately, Bonaparte didn't offer an alternative for the Democrats, the small state Democrats across Europe. The fourth way was often associated with the United States. The United States, many Europeans obviously fled because of the turmoil of revolutionary Europe. The United States is seen as potentially an idyllic republic for Republicans and Democrats, partly because of the classical lineage. The fact of slavery made North America look like a classical republic, much more than many European republics. The fact that in North America you have so much land, so people, everybody could be a citizen with a stake in the society. And as time passes, the American Republic remains a model. The tragedy, one of the tragedies, I suppose, of European perspectives on North America is gradually they begin to describe it as just another empire, as not as a special democratic state, but as a state that will simply relive the history of the European monarchies as a republic. It will turn itself into an empire. It will follow Britain in being obsessed with commerce, and it cannot be trusted to protect the small states that surround it or the small states that it's allied with across the globe. So that's another tragedy, but it's another story. What I'll finish with are a couple of things that intellectual historians always look for, which is historical irony. And there are three ironies. And there's a final unintended consequence, which is another thing that you're always very pleased if you can find as an intellectual historian. The irony is that the French revolutionary state, the democracy that Rowlandson and Gilray and Cruikshank and so many others were attacking, seemed to confirm the prejudice against democracy. It confirmed the prejudice against democracy because it failed in 1799 and then when Bonaparte became first consul and then when Bonaparte became an emperor. So into the 19th century, people thought democracy was proved to have failed because France had gone the same way as Rome. It had ended in a military dictatorship, and that always happens when you give the people power. So the irony is that the prejudices against democracy in the 18th century were confirmed. The second irony is that what we now call democracy, representative government, was described in the 18th century as a way of avoiding the people having a voice. Representation is associated with aristocracy, it's associated with stability, it's associated with a British constitution that is just not democratic at all. People praised Britain and valued the British state because it was not democratic. The third irony, and I'm almost finished, was that the voice of the small states, the small state democracy, the states that had looked to revolutionary France and had looked to Britain, that voice was drowned out and it was lost. The association of small communities with democracy, it was lost. The reason why across Europe people were so fascinated with Scotland is because they thought that they saw in the history of Scotland evidence that the British Union, the Anglo-Scots Union, worked. They thought that if you were that you could see Scotland as a small state whose laws, separate laws, whose separate culture, whose separate manners, distinctive history, had all been maintained in the Union. So they were fascinated by Scottish history because it seemed to show that Britain was not a rapacious, awful, commercial, mercantile state, that actually, if the Scots remained Scots, then potentially, as a small state republican, you had a future. So the Europeans, especially in the small communities, become fascinated by Scotland because they think it's a possible future for them. The final point is to do with the unintended consequence. The way that people thought about politics in the 18th century, and especially in the small states, in the democratic communities that I've been talking about, was with reference to history. If you want to make a political argument, it's always going to be particular. There are no universal rules. There are no general truths. You have to look at the particular situation, at a particular circumstance, in order to make any claim. That kind of argument in politics was especially associated with the small communities. The unintended consequence of their fall, of their collapse, of their incorporation into larger commercial polities, into larger empires, was that, and with the French Revolution proving, seemingly, that democracy was a universal reality, history, the historical perspective on politics, declines. In the 19th century, you could say that it's lost. And that, I think you'll agree, was a tragedy. Thank you very much.